Good evening. We apologise most sincerely to those of you who have bought this record under the impression that it was in any way connected with the television programme Monty Python's Flying Circus. This was due to an error in the printing stage of the album cover. This album is in fact called Pleasures of the Dance, a collection of Norwegian Carpenter's songs compiled by Oscar Tritt.
Good evening. We apologise for the previous apology. This apology was unnecessary and appeared on the record owing to an administrative error. This album is not, as stated in the previous apology, Pleasures of the Dance, a selection of Norwegian Carpenter's songs, but a new album from the humorous television comedy show Monty Python's Flying Circus.
This was the Trondheim Hammerdance, which is held every 25 minutes in the town of Trondheim, in which the old ladies are struck about the head with round sticks or knödel.
We apologise for that short extract from the Pleasures of the Dance, which appeared on this record of Monty Python's Flying Circus, owing to the same administrative error which resulted in the first apology. The rest of this record is now totally taken up with Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Jarrow, New Year's Eve, 1911.
Come in!
Trouble at mill.
Oh, no. What kind of trouble?
One old flare rod's gone out of skew on treadle.
What?
One old flare rod's gone out of...
We would like to apologise to those people who may have heard a short extract from Pleasures of the Dance, a selection of Norwegian Carpenter songs, earlier in this record. This appeared in error and will not be repeated.
Skew on treadle!
I can't understand what you're saying.
One of the flay rods has gone out of skew, apparently, on the treadle.
What on earth does that mean?
Well, I don't know. Mr. Wentworth told me to come and say there was trouble at the mill, that's all. I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
Nobody expects a Spanish Inquisition. Our weapon is supplies. Supplies and fear. Fear and supplies are two weapons. Our fear and supplies and the ruthless efficiency are three weapons. Our fear and supplies and the ruthless efficiency and an almost fanatical devotion to the Pope. Amongst our weapons are fear, supplies, ruth... Amongst our weaponry are such elements as... A fear... I'll come in again.
Well, I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Amongst our weaponry are such diverse elements as a fear, a surprise, a ruthless efficiency, and an almost fanatical devotion to the Pope, and a night out with the naval... Oh! It's no good. I'm sorry. Cardinal Biggles, you'll have to say it.
What?
You'll have to say our chief weapons are.
Oh, I couldn't say that.
I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
Nobody.
Expects.
Nobody expects the Spanish.
Inquisition.
No, I know. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. In fact, those who do expect...
Our chief weapon is...
Supplies and...
Stop there. I got it. All right. Our chief weapon is supplies, blah, 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 blah. Now, Cardinal Fang, read the charges.
£1 for a full sketch, 24p for a quickie.
What'll you have?
Sketch, please.
Good evening and welcome to World Forum. Tonight is indeed a unique moment in the history of television. we are very privileged and deeply honoured to have with us in the studio Karl Marx, the founder of modern socialism and author of the Communist Manifesto. Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, better known to the world as Lenin, leader of the Russian Revolution, writer, statesman and father of modern communism. Che Guevara, the Bolivian guerrilla leader. And Mao Zedong, chairman of the Chinese Communist Party since 1949. And the first question is for you, Karl Marx. The Hammers. The Hammers is the nickname of what English football team? The Hammers. No, well, bad luck, Karl. It is, in fact, West Ham United. Now, Che Guevara, Che, Coventry City last won the FA Cup in what year? No? I'm going to have to throw the question open. Anyone else? Coventry City last won the FA Cup in what year? No, well, I'm not surprised you didn't get it. It was a trick question. Coventry City have never won the FA Cup. So now with the scores all equal, it's on to our second round, and Lenin, your starter for 10. Tenny Johnson and Pearl Carr won the Eurovision Song Contest in 1959. What was the name of the song? Teddy Johnson and Pearl Carr's winning song in the 1959 Eurovision Song Contest? No? Yes, Mao Zedong.
Sing a little birdie?
Yes, it was indeed well challenged. Well, now we come to our special gift section. Our contestant is Karl Marx, and the prize this week is a beautiful lounge suite. Now, Karl has asked for questions on the workers' control of factories, so here we go with number one. Are you nervous, Karl?
A little, yes.
The development of the industrial proletariat is conditioned by what other development?
The development of the industrial bourgeoisie.
Good! Yes, that's wrong. You're on your way to the lounge suite. Now, number two, Karl. The struggle of class against class is a what struggle? A what struggle?
A political struggle.
Yes, yes. Very good, Karl. Now, one more question and that beautiful lounge suite is yours. Are you going to try?
Yes, please.
You're a brave man, Karl. So, Karl Marx, here is your last question. Who won the cup final in 1949?
The workers controlled the means of production. No, the struggle of the urban proletarian.
No, it was Wolverhampton Wanderers who beat Leicester 3-1.
Listening to this record with my wife and our au pair, and I'd like to say how shocked we are that a pleasant collection of Norwegian folk songs should be turned into an excuse for communist propaganda of the shoddiest kind. What's gone wrong with the world? I can't even take a bath without 6 or 7 communists jumping in with me. They're in my shirt cupboard, and Brezhnev and Kosygin are in the kitchen now, eating my wife's jam. Oh, they're climbing up my legs, and I can see them peeping out of my wife's blouse. Why doesn't Mr. Maudling do something before it's too late? Oh, God!
And several butchers' aprons. The next groove on this record has been electronically engineered by some of the world's finest craftsmen to bring to your homes the full, glorious spectacle of Gumby Theatre.
Gumby Theatre comes live tonight from the Yvonne Gumby Theatre near Guildford. L.D. Gumby, M.J. Gumby and R.S. Gumby star in The Cherry Orchard by Anton Chekhov. The action takes place near Moscow in the 1870s.
Come in! Open the door and come in!
Sorry!
Hello!
Gumby!
Oh, my brain hurts!
Shut up!
Sorry!
Oh!
Meanwhile, in St. Petersburg, Ilya Nataevska and Mariana Plyankov await news of their stepbrother Trofimov.
Hello! I broke it!
Get off me!
That was The Cherry Orchard by Anton Chekhov, adapted for radio by putting it onto a piece of wood and banging a few nails through it. Mr. L.N. Gumby is now appearing in the Thames near Wapping Steps, and Mr. D.P. Gumby is appearing as a central tunnel support on the new Victoria line. And now, book at bedtime. This week's book is The House at Pooh Corner, read by Mr. N.D. Gumby.
With me now is Norman St. John Pulvalter, who for the last few years has been contradicting people. St. John Pulvalter, why do you contradict people?
I don't!
But you told me that you did.
I most certainly did not!
Oh, I see. I'll start again.
No, you won't!
Shh! I understand you don't contradict people.
Yes, I do.
And when didn't you start contradicting them?
I did, in 1952.
1952?
1947.
23 years ago.
No!
Then the old ladies are thrown into the fields with their boots tied around their necks.
Now, gentlemen, we have two basic suggestions for the architectural design of this residential block. And I thought it better that the architects themselves demonstrate the particular advantages of their designs. That's probably the first architect now. Mr. Wiggin of Ironside and Malone.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is a model of a 12-story block, combining classical neo-Georgian features with the efficiencies of modern techniques. The tenants arrive here in the entrance hall, are carried along the corridor on a conveyor belt in extreme comfort, past murals depicting Mediterranean scenes, towards the rotating knives. The last 20 feet of the corridor are heavily soundproofed. The blood pours down these chutes, and the mangled flesh slurps into these large...
Excuse me.
Yes?
Did you say knives?
Rotating knives, yes?
Are you proposing to slaughter our tenants?
Does that not fit in with your plans?
No, it does not. We asked for a simple block of flats.
Yeah. I hadn't fully divined your attitude towards the tenants. You see, I mainly design slaughterhouses. Pity. Mind you, this is a real beaut. None of your blood caked on the walls and flesh flying out of the windows incommoding the passers-by with this one. My life has been leading up to this.
Yes, and well done, but we wanted an apartment block.
Well, may I ask you to reconsider? You wouldn't regret this. Think of the tourist trade.
I'm sorry, but we want a block of flats, not an abattoir.
Yes, well, that's the sort of blinkered Philistine pig ignorance I've come to expect from you, non-creative garbage. You sit there on your loathsome spotty behind, squeezing blackheads, not caring a tinker's cuss for the struggling artist, you excrement. You whining, hypocritical toadies with your colour TV sets and your Tony Jacklin golf clubs and your bleeding Masonic secret handshakes. You wouldn't let me join, would you, blackballing bastards? Well, I wouldn't become a Freemason now if you went down on your lousy, stinking knees and begged me!
Well, we're sorry you feel that way, but we did want a block of flats. Nice though the abattoir is.
Oh, sod the abattoir. It's not important, but if any of you could put in a word for me, I'd love to be a Mason. Masonry opens doors. I'd be very quiet. I was a bit on edge just now, but if I were a Mason, I'd sit at the back and not get in anyone's way.
Thank you.
I've got a second-hand apron.
Thank you.
I nearly got in at Hendon.
Thank you.
Well, have we anyone else to see?
Yes, there's the Spanish Inquisition.
Oh, I didn't expect the Spanish Inquisition.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Our chief weapon is surprise. That's all. Just surprise.
What about fear?
Oh, yes, all right. Surprise and fear.
And the fanatical...
Shut up! Right.
Yeah, accused of heresy on three counts. Heresy by thought, heresy by word, heresy by deed, and heresy by action. Four counts. Now, you have one last chance. Confess the heinous sin of heresy. Reject the works of the ungodly. Two last chances. And you shall be free. Three last chances. You have three last chances. Unrighteous creatures, how do you plead? Where's everybody gone? Cardinal Fang? Cardinal Fang!
Sorry, my lord, we were just having a cup of tea with these architects.
Shut up!
And you've got these lovely little chocolate cake with silver balls.
Shut up, Jesuit face!
And these goodies with our little spangles and in wonderful tea. Shut up, you kind son of the bacon.
And now, choice of viewing on BBC Television. Just started on BBC Two, the semi-final of episode 3 of Kierkegaard's Journals, starring Richard Chamberlain, Peggy Mount and Billy Bremner. And on BBC One now, Ethel the Frog.
Good evening. On Ethel the Frog tonight, we look at violence, the violence of British gangland. Last Tuesday, a reign of terror was ended when the notorious Piranha brothers, Doug and Dinsdale, after one of the most extraordinary trials in British legal history, were sentenced to 400 years imprisonment for crimes of violence. Tonight, Ethel the Frog examines the rise to power of the Piranhas and their subsequent tracking and capture by the brilliant Superintendent Harry Snapper Organs of Q Division.
Doug and Dinsdale Piranha were born on probation in Kipling Road, Southwark. Their father, Arthur Piranha, a scrap metal dealer and TV quizmaster, was well known to the police and a devout Catholic. In January 1928, he had married Kitty Malone, an up-and-coming East End boxer. Doug was born in February 1929 and Dinsdale 2 weeks later, and again a week after that. Their next-door neighbour, Mrs. Lamberta Simnel.
Kipling Road was a typical East End street. People were in and out of each other's houses with each other's property all day long. Yes, they were a cheery lot. Cheery and violent. I remember Doug was keen on boxing, but when he learned to walk, he took up putting the boot in the groin.
When the Piranhas left school, they were called up, but were found by an army board to be too mentally unstable, even for national service. Denied the opportunity to use their talents in the service of their country, they began to operate what they called the operation. They would select a victim and then threaten to beat him up if he paid them the so-called protection money. 4 months later, they started another operation, which they called the Other Operation. In this racket, they selected another victim and threatened not to beat him up if he didn't pay them. 1 month later, they hit upon the Other Operation. In this, the victim was threatened that if he didn't pay them, they would beat him up. This, for the Piranha Brothers, was the turning point.
Superintendent Harry Snapper Organs of Q Division takes up the story.
Doug and Dinsdale Piranha now formed a gang, which they called The Gang, and used terror to take over nightclubs, billiard halls, gaming casinos and racetracks. When they tried to take over the MCC, they were, for the only time in their lives, slit up a treat. As their empire spread, however, we in Q Division were keeping tabs on their every movement by reading the colour supplements.
One small-time operator who fell foul of Dinsdale Piranha was Vince Snetterton Lewis.
Well, one day I was at home threatening the kids, when I looks out through the hole in the wall and I sees this tank pull up, and out gets one of Dinsdale's boys. So he chains me to the back of the tank and takes me for a scrape round to Dinsdale's place. And Dinsdale's there in the conversation pit with Doug and Charles Paisley, the baby crusher, and two film producers, and a man they called Kierkegaard, who just sat there biting the heads off whippets. And Dinsdale just says, "Oh, you've been a naughty boy, Clement." And he splits me nostrils open and saws me leg off and pulls me liver out. And I tell him my name's not Clement. And then he loses his temper and nails my head to the floor.
He nailed your head to the floor?
At first, yeah.
Another man who had his head nailed to the floor was Stig O'Tracy.
Stig, I've been told Dinsdale Piranha nailed your head to the floor.
No, never! He was a smashing bloke. He used to buy his mother flowers and that. He was like a brother to me.
But the police have film of Dinsdale actually nailing your head to the floor.
Oh, yeah, he did that.
Why?
Well, he had to. I had transgressed the unwritten law.
What had you done?
Well, he didn't tell me that. But he gave me his word that it was the case, and that's good enough for me with old Dinsy. I mean, he didn't want to nail my head to the floor. I had to insist. He wanted to let me off.
I understand he also nailed your wife's head to a coffee table.
Yeah, he did that. He was a cruel man, but fair.
Clearly, Dinsdale inspired tremendous fear among his business associates. But what was he really like?
I walked out with Dinsdale on many occasions, and I found him a charming and erudite companion. He was wont to introduce one to eminent celebrities, celebrated American singers, members of the aristocracy, and other gang leaders.
How had he met them?
Through his wonderful work for charity. He took a warm interest in boys' clubs, sailors' homes, choristers' associations, and the Grenadier Guards.
Was there anything unusual about him?
I should bleeding well say not, except that Dinsdale was convinced that he was being watched by a giant hedgehog, whom he referred to as Spinning Norman.
How big was Norman supposed to be?
Normally, he was wont to be about 12 feet from his head to his anus. And when he was about, Dinsdale would go very quiet and start wobbling, and his nose would swell up, and his teeth would move about, and he'd get very violent and claim that he laid Stanley Baldwin.
Did it worry you that he, for example, stitched people's legs together?
Well, it's better than bottling it up, innit? He was a gentleman, Dinsdale. What's more, he knew how to treat a female impersonator.
Most of these strange tales concern Dinsdale. But what of Doug? One man who met him was Luigi Vercotti.
I'd been running a successful escort agency. High class, no, really, high class girls. Didn't have any of that. That was right out. Hello? Not now. Stum. Yeah, well, you'll have the watch ready for you at midnight. The watch. The Chinese watch. Right, bye-bye. Mother. So I decided to open an high-class nightclub for the gentry at Biggleswade with international cuisine and cooking and top-line acts and not a cheap clip joint for picking up tarts. That was right out. I deny that completely. Shut that door! And one evening, in walks Dinsdale with a couple of big lads, one of whom was carrying a tactical nuclear missile. They said I'd bought one of their fruit machines and would I pay for it.
How much did they ask?
£750,000.
Why didn't you go to the police?
Well, I noticed that the lad with the thermonuclear device was the chief constable for the area. So a week later, they called again, told me the check had bounced, and said I have to see Doug.
Doug.
Doug. Well, I was terrified. Everyone was terrified of Doug. I've seen grown men pull their own heads off rather than see Doug. Even Dinsdale was frightened of Doug.
What did Doug do?
He used sarcasm. He knew all the tricks. Dramatic irony, metaphor, bathos, puns, parody, hyperbole, litotes and satire. He was vicious. Shut that bleeding door!
In this way, by a combination of violence and sarcasm, the Piranha Brothers by February 1966 controlled London and the southeast of England. It was in February, though, that Dinsdale made a big mistake. In a fit of pique, he napalmed Cheltenham. Even the police began to sit up and take notice.
The Piranhas realised they'd gone too far and that the hunt was on. They went into hiding. I decided on a subtle approach, viz. Some form of disguise, as the old helmet and boots were a bit of a giveaway. Luckily, my years with Bristol Rep stood me in good stead, as I assumed a bewildering variety of disguises. I tracked them to Cardiff, posing as the Reverend Smiler Egret. Hearing they'd gone back to London, I assumed the identity of a pork butcher, Brian Stoats. On my arrival in London, I discovered they had returned to Cardiff. I followed as Gloucester from King Lear. Acting on an hunch, I spent several months in Buenos Aires as Blind Pew, returning through the Panama Canal as Ratty in Toad of Toad Hall. Back in Cardiff, I relived my triumph as Sancho Panza in Man of La Mancha, which the Bristol Evening Post described as a glittering performance of rare perception, although the Bath Chronicle was less than enthusiastic. In fact, it gave me a right penning. Quote.
As for the performance of Superintendent Harry Snapper Organs as Sancho Panza, the audience were bemused by his high-pitched Welsh accent, his abusive ad-libs, and his persistent unscheduled appearances and cries of "What's all this, then?" during the rape scene.
The police now began to close the net around the Piranha Brothers, and it was in a last desperate attempt to forestall the inevitable that Doug and Dinsdale went to a small house in Stepney, where they...
Excuse me?
Yes?
I got a message from Dinsdale. He likes this record very much, but him and some of the boys have the feeling that this last item has gone on a bit too long.
Well, I'm afraid I disagree. I think a story like this needs time to
develop. No, you misunderstand me. He don't want to debate about it. Dinsdale thinks that the humorous impact will be somewhat dissipated by the prolongation of this item.
Well, I'm afraid I'm not prepared.
Oh, sorry, Squire. I'll scratch the record. 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 Sorry, Squire. I'll scratch the record.